This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehisu Heeb, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Zimbabwe's High Court has struck down the government's two-week ban on demonstrations. The ban was imposed as anti-government protests were gaining momentum.
That's reporter Sebastian Monfu in Harare. Details next.
Also, amid growing calls for a recount, Gabon President Ali Bongo has accused his political opponent of ballot fraud and leading a plot to seize power. And AFP reports Equatorial Guinea's vice president and the son of the president, Teodorin Obiang, will stand trial in France on corruption charges.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Zimbabwe's High Court has struck down the government's two-week ban on demonstrations. The ban was imposed as anti-government protests were gaining momentum. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare.
The ban was announced last Thursday, a day before opposition parties were to hold an anti-government demonstration in the capital. But High Court Justice Priscilla Chigumba ruled Wednesday that the government's ban was, quote, invalid, unquote, because it was done unprocedurally. She issued the ruling despite the remarks from President Robert Mugabe lambasting judges who have been allowing Zimbabweans to protest against the 92-year-old president's leadership. Politician Tendai Biti, a member of Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights who represented the opposition in court, said Mugabe's statements were not appropriate.
He has no right to make those statements, president's statement. They are unconstitutional. The first function of the president is actually to uphold the constitution and the Bill of Rights. That's his first function. So if the president fails in that function, he must resign or be impeached.
Rights groups such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have added their concern to the statement by Mugabe attacking the granting of protests by Zimbabwean judges. Here is Human Rights Watch's Dewa Mavinga, a senior researcher for Southern Africa.
President Mugabe's statements undermine Zimbabwe's international human rights law obligations to respect due process and judicial independence, which are guaranteed under the African Commission on Human and People's Rights Charter, as well as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Zimbabweans have the right to peaceful protest and to express their views freely, and judges should not be constrained in enforcing those rights.
It was not immediately known if the opposition will resume protests, which Mugabe says are alien and lead to violence in Zimbabwe. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
In Zimbabwe, the health of aging President Robert Mugabe is a frequent topic of national debate. Last week, the 92-year-old leader hopped on a Zimbabwe Airlines flight that headed towards Singapore, his usual stop for his medical needs. But the plane changed course for Dubai, where possibly two of his three children and a new grandchild are reported to be living. Government officials still don't talk about where Mr. Mugabe was for those 4 days or why he was absent. A political observer in Johannesburg says it might have more to do with who will become the next president. Piers Pigou is senior consultant on South Africa for the International Conflict Group in Johannesburg. He talked to VOA's David Arnold about succession politics in Harare.
There's some mystery, of course, as to what happened last week, because Mr. Mugabe and the presidency, it would appear, deliberately kept the rest of his government in the dark as to what he was doing. No one seemed to be able to officially tell the public what was going on, and Mr. Mugabe presumably knew that there was huge speculation about his medical conditions, and sources within the government strongly indicated that there was this problem. The question is, why would he act in such an irresponsible way of allowing the flames uncertainty to be stoked in this way? The rumour mill and the speculation mill is going wild at the moment, trying to understand what he was doing. That he took a state asset and took it out of the country to Dubai for, apparently, according to his own reasoning, to sort things out with his child. It's a bizarre scenario. It takes the whole death watch around Mugabe to another level, but is very much tied into the kind of factional dynamics that are taking place in the country at the moment. And many people believe that this actually now was an attempt to test the acting president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, to see what he would do, and was part of the whole factional fight between people that support Mnangagwa and those that are opposed to him.
What's your take on the factionalism now?
Well, there is a growing sense that Mr. Mnangagwa is being weakened by a growing capture of different positions and removal by the Generation 40 group. There is this huge unanswered question about the position of the security sector, particularly the Zimbabwe Defense Force commander, Constantine Chiwenga, has been extremely critical of G40 elements. The push by the G40 grouping for an elective process in the national conference in December is something which may well help determine where positions will go further down the line.
Is succession still possible within the party, or does this give the opposition a better opportunity?
Well, you would think that the internal fracturing of ZANU-PF would be something that would provide the opportunity for exploitation by the opposition. And to date, I think we could say that that's been somewhat limited. However, within the last month or so, we have seen, on the back of popular protests that are coming from a range of different sources, predicated largely, I think, by the deteriorating and ongoing deterioration of the economy, that we've seen political parties converging around particular issues in a way that we haven't seen before. So in June, we saw the formation of a group called CODE, four smaller parties, and then we've seen this broader coalition of groupings under the banner of the National Electoral Reform Agenda, NERA, which led the demonstrations a week or so ago that were violently repressed by the police. While we're seeing a consolidation at that level, the extent to which that reflects an exploitation of the weakness is debatable, but there's a mood in opposition politics that we haven't seen for some time. And of course, the state is reacting to that with a very belligerent narrative and accusations against the West and against others of a regime change agenda, which is fairly sort of standard practice for them. But I think the difficulty for the state is twofold. One, in that opposition and the protest is coming from a multiplicity of sources. So it's a bit like the kid putting his finger in the dike, trying to stop the leaks. And on the other hand, of course, the internal factionalism within the party means that the command structure around a repressive response is perhaps tempered somewhat. Also because, of course, the state is trying to present to the international community that it is committed to a reform agenda in terms of its re-engagement with international financial institutions and primarily Western interlocutors to access new lines of credit.
You mentioned the multiplicity of forces at work now in the last couple of months. Who is likely to be a leader of these forces?
Well, I think that's one of the big challenges for the opposition groupings. The social protests that we've seen do not have a clear leadership to them. It's been an attempt to sort of push up people like the pastor, Evans Mawarire, as some kind of leader. But these have been largely organic, supported certainly by largely Zimbabwean elements internally and externally. But these are not people who are leading a political charge. Now we're seeing the politicians, to a certain extent, jumping onto that wave and capturing the mood of these things. So it's going to be very interesting to see how those popular protests relate to the political opposition and the efforts of the political opposition in terms of the strategies and the tactics that are employed now.
That was Pierre Spigu in Johannesburg. He talked to VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C.
Fourteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Gabon President Ali Bongo has accused his political opponent of ballot fraud and leading a plot to seize power. Mr. Bongo made the comments amid growing calls for a recount in last Wednesday's election in which he defeated Jean Ping. The margin of victory was less than 6,000 votes. European Union observers and others say there were irregularities in the vote, especially in a province considered a Bongo stronghold. They say voter turnout in the province was inflated with a figure of more than 99%. The Associated Press reports political opponents have until tomorrow to file any legal challenges against the election results. The vote count still must be certified by the Constitutional Court, which has the power to order a recount. Jean Ping has called the election a fraud and that he is the rightful winner. Mr. Bongo has accused Ping of fraud and that he had help from cyber criminals. Today, the capital, Libreville, is reportedly calm and businesses are open.
The son of Equatorial Guinea's president will stand trial in France on corruption charges. AFP reports Teodoron Obiang, the country's vice president, is accused of using public funds to pay for his fast-paced lifestyle. That includes the purchase of private jets, luxury cars, and pop star Michael Jackson's famous white glove. A trial date has not been set yet for Obiang, who is 47 years old. He allegedly used frontmen and shell companies to launder money for corruption and embezzlement. The charges are the first to be filed as part of a major financial investigation of several African leaders. French authorities raided the Obiang family home in Paris in 2012. His father, Theodore Obiang Nguema, has ruled Equatorial Guinea since 1979.
More than 350 rescued migrants arrived in Sicily today. Reuters says they were found aboard an overcrowded dinghy on the Mediterranean. The bodies of seven dead migrants were also on board. Also today, German Chancellor Angela Merkel is defending her migrant and refugee policies. She says Germans have nothing to fear, adding there are more jobs and pensions have increased. Speaking to Parliament, Ms. Merkel says tax revenues and the economy are strong. Her comments follow a state election this week in which her Christian Democratic Party lost to an anti-immigrant party called Alternative for Germany. Meanwhile, in Hungary, a camerawoman for a right-wing TV channel who kicked child refugees trying to cross the Serbian border has been charged with breaching the peace. The AP reports Petra Laszlo had apologized for her actions after video of her harassing refugees went viral. She said she panicked when refugees broke through police lines. Laszlo was fired from her job. She now says she is considering moving to Russia. Also in Hungary, voters will decide in an October 2nd referendum whether they agree with the EU plan mandating the relocation of refugees without the approval of local parliaments.
Extremist and terrorist groups in North Africa and the Sahel may have different objectives and tactics, but they tend to cooperate in exploiting ungoverned areas. Ambassador Alberto Fernandez is the former director of State Department Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about the real relationship between terrorist groups like Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and ISIS.
There is a relationship between those groups because they all are related in a specific worldview, and they call themselves Salafi jihadist groups. So that's a specific ideology with a specific focus and way of carrying out violence and carrying out war. So there is a connection between the three, without a doubt.
Why some non-ISIS groups give allegiance to ISIS?
Well, I mean, you have to go back in history to realize that the rise of the Islamic State after the announcement of the caliphate in June 2014 was a huge shock for the global jihadist movement. And some organizations wanted to be on the what looked at the time on the winning side, on the right side. Just like many individuals were radicalized in the West or in the Middle East, these organizations that have either been independent, like Boko Haram, or have been part of Al-Qaeda, wanted to be with the strongest horse, the organization that looked like it had the momentum. So they shifted and went with it. Of course, 2 years later, the Islamic State doesn't look as powerful as it did in 2014. And many in 2014 thought Al-Qaeda was finished and ISIS would replace it. The situation today is, of course, much more complicated.
But these terrorist groups have different objectives. What is in common between them?
A couple of things. The Salafi jihadist worldview is the overall ideological framework for what they do. That means several things. Number one, it means the concept of the violent, coercive imposition of Sharia on populations. And number two, the use of violence, what we would call terrorist violence and also insurgent violence, against a wide range of enemies, non-Muslims, governments, Muslims that are seen as supporting those governments, Muslims that are somehow seen as heterodox or not Islamic enough, like Sufis, like Shia, like other minorities, like secularists. So those two things, an emphasis on violence and an emphasis on imposing some form of what they present as an authentic Islamic government, usually described as the imposition of Sharia.
So far, counterterrorism efforts focus only on the military aspect with an obvious lack of concerted effort on fighting the ideologies. What's your take on that?
Well, the reason they do it, of course, it's fighting is in a way easier. But fighting, waging war, is more linear, more straightforward than a kind of ideological struggle. First of all, you have to be very careful if you're going to wage an ideological struggle. You have to understand the enemy very well. You have to understand yourself very well. We see, for example, in the United States, the discourse on ISIS, on Al-Qaeda, and on Islam, and all too often what we see are extremes. We have people saying, the problem is Islam. That's one extreme. And you have others saying, the problem has nothing to do with Islam. That's the other extreme. So it's difficult for government and for those who want to do right and who want to work with government to thread the needle between those two extremes and say the worldview of these extremists, the ideology of these extremists, is grounded in a specific historic reading of Islam taken from the time of the Salaf and reinterpreted in history in the recent past. It's something very specific. It's neither not Islamic or completely Islamic. And so it's difficult. It's a much harder lift for governments and for others to do than just bombing people. Just bombing people or killing them with a drone is in a way simpler than waging an ideological struggle effectively.
Ambassador Alberto Fernandez is a former director of the State Department Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
A new report says much of Africa has enjoyed growing agriculture productivity since 2005. The study came out yesterday at the African Green Revolution Forum taking place in Nairobi, Kenya. The report also identifies countries where investments have helped boost farm production and GDP growth. And it identifies countries that need help in making agriculture the driver of Africa's economic growth. Dr. David Ameya is Director of Monitoring and Evaluation at the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. He spoke with me about the report's findings and what it means for future food security in Africa.
In 2013, African head of state made a commitment in Maputo to commit 10% of their national budget to help achieve the CADAP goals and objectives. And also through its mutual accountability framework, CADAP was to promote a peer review, dialogue, and learning with countries across the regions to implement those targets. What this report shows that since those countries who have made commitments to spend 10% of their national budget towards agriculture have seen an increase in agriculture growth, reduction in poverty, and also reduction in malnutrition.
What are some examples of how the investments are paying off?
You will see that the countries that made that commitment and have countries such as Rwanda, countries such as Ghana, Tanzania, Ethiopia, agricultural growth ranges between 5 6.7% per annum in those countries. Also, you will see that those countries have experienced poverty reduction. You will see that on average, some of those countries have moved from a poverty level of about 35% to about 20 and 25%. You will also see that malnutrition, which in some of these countries were averaging about 35% of their population, have come down in a country like Ghana to about 15%.
What does this mean then for these countries in Africa regarding food security on a long-term basis?
This is what this year's report is about. If we have seen that there's an increase in productivity, it shows that Africa is going to be able to feed ourselves if this trajectory goes on. And the reason why we are saying that is that with increased urbanization in Africa, with the youth population growing on in Africa, you will see that a continent that has about 60% of its population involved in agriculture and that produce about 80% of their domestic food consumption, if we are able to bridge the food yield gap, then Africa will be able to feed itself and be able to support the world food security problems.
In addition to the progress that was pointed out in this research, experts identified several areas that need attention. What are these areas and in what countries?
In the report, we propose about 7 action plans that are needed to sustain and maintain this growth. First, we propose that the political leadership and commitment that was exhibited in the 2003 Maputo Declaration and which have been affirmed in the 2014 Malabo Declaration should continue. And if they are able to continue, it will show a tremendous increase. Secondly, we need to promote a broad-based agricultural growth. And when we talk about broad-based agricultural growth, we are talking about growth that will be a foundation for the overall economic growth. The report noted that virtually no country in the world has ever successfully transformed its economy from an agrarian to a modern economy with low poverty rate without sustained agriculture productivity growth.
Also, I wanted to ask you briefly about the Africa Food Prize. Can you tell us who is getting the prize?
The Africa Food Prize, which is the first of its kind on the continent, is today around 7 o'clock Nairobi time, is going to be awarded to the current president of IFAD, who is Dr. Kanayo. He is the nominated candidate to receive the Africa Food Prize this evening. And we congratulate him for his accomplishment and years of dedication to Africa food security issues.
Dr. David Ameya is head of monitoring and evaluation at the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, AGRA. He spoke with me from Nairobi.
Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in Africa news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.